implement a law protecting the rights of transgender students while an opposition group gathers signatures for a repeal initiative.
In Syria, a polio epidemic is spreading amidst the chaos of civil war.
A Ukrainian journalist known for her investigations into corruption has been brutally beaten by several attackers.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 26th, 2013. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Earlier this week, environmentalists and Umatilla Indian tribe gathered in protest of the second of three convoys of oil refinery equipment. The megaload convoy traveled through eastern Oregon to the tar sands oil region of Alberta, Canada. The Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation and activists joined together in songs of prayer along Highway 395 in Pendleton. No arrests were reported. Approximately 50 people gathered where Hillsboro-based trucking company Omega Morgan parked the convoy. The third convoy will depart the port of Umatilla. The latest megaloads consist of giant evaporators designed for recycling water from steam-injected underground to melt out bitumen, a substance that's refined into crude oil. Leaders of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation opposed the trek because the state government has not properly consulted with them about the shipment through land the tribe ceded in 1855. Environmental activists say the extraction of bitumen to make oil requires huge amounts of energy, which is generated by burning petroleum products, therefore speeding climate change. Environmental activists oppose the tar sands oil for its outsized carbon emissions and because Keystone XL pipeline could leak, spilling dirty tar sands petroleum into rivers or aquifers.
Last week, the Portland City Council passed a collective bargaining agreement between the city and the Portland Police Association. Also, there was an agreement between the city, the police bureau, and the union on reforms that were called for by the U.S. Department of Justice. The DOJ released a report earlier in the year that took the police bureau to task for excessive use of force and recommended several changes to training and internal investigation procedures. The city accepted this report, but changes have been slow in coming due to complaints from the police union that changes will undermine collective bargaining agreements. This agreement has been controversial among community groups and police accountability advocates who think it has not gone far enough towards increasing accountability and transparency for investigations into police misconduct. The agreement will go before a federal judge at a fairness hearing on February the 18th when members of the community can testify about the effectiveness of the reforms. For more on this, KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch.
Does the agreement that was passed by the council last week move forward at all in preventing the excessive use of force against people with mental illness?
It moves the ability for the court system to oversee the agreement that the city and the DOJ have been working on for a year. So now the community's turn to get involved is coming up. So in other words, like between November of 2012 and December of 2013, a lot of changes have been going on behind the scenes where the community hasn't had a lot of input because the DOJ and the city have been working without asking people for their input. The judge is asking for people's input in a what's called a fairness hearing that's coming up in February.
And what could the result of that hearing be? He can't strike down individual parts of the agreement, is that right?
No, unfortunately, that's what we were all hoping for. But what he can do is say, after he hears testimony, I'm hoping that everybody who listens to KBOO will familiarize themselves with the information about this DOJ agreement and this fairness hearing and testify before the judge, either in person or in writing or on video. If he hears enough people say, what has been agreed to is not adequate, fair, and reasonable, then he can turn to the city and the DOJ and say, look, you know, I can't enter this agreement into the court record because I've heard too many people from the community say that you didn't go far enough. And that's basically where we're trying to get the judge to go, is to order them back to the table so that we can get some of the changes in there that we really wanted from the beginning, and the city and the DOJ just wouldn't put them in there.
If they did go back to the table, would they be able to do something like get rid of the 48-hour rule where a officer involved in a shooting can't be interviewed until 48 hours after the event?
Well, so the city's opportunity to really do that was wasted, and this is part of where there are a lot of moving parts that are going on here. And what happened last week was that the city passed two things. They passed the new contract with the Portland Police Association that people call the police union, and they passed the police association's agreement that they weren't going to stand in the way of the DOJ a settlement going before the court. And when they negotiated the new collective bargaining agreement with the police association, they did not do anything to remove that 48-hour rule you're talking about. So it's not clear to me that the DOJ and the city can do anything in the agreement to get rid of that, because technically they would have to go back and reopen bargaining with the police association to get rid of that.
Another problem among a few that, for example, the Albina Ministerial Alliance has pointed out is they set a 180-day timeline to complete investigations into officer misconduct.
Right.
And so would an investigation get thrown out if it went past that?
Well, the way the agreement is written, a person could interpret it that way. Yes, it says all investigations shall be completed in 180 days, including any appeals to what's called the Citizen Review Committee, which is what people think of as our police review board here. And that review body currently takes 60 to 90 days to do its appeal. And so therefore, if the Bureau takes 175 days to do an investigation, and then you file an appeal about the investigation because you didn't like the outcome, that body will only have 5 days left to do it. Even if there's a loophole where they say 180 days is not the end of the whole thing, you just have to write a letter and explain why it took longer, which is where things are headed right now, they want the review body to complete those hearings in 21 days. And these are all volunteers, and I don't know how they expect anybody to do a fair appeal hearing of any kind, whether you're a judge, an administrative person inside the city that hears non-judicial complaints between citizens, or citizen volunteers hearing police accountability things. I don't know how anybody expects a fair appeal hearing to be held in 21 days, but that's written in the agreement now. So there's a bunch of stuff like that that's just going to hamper our abilities as a community to organize for fair accountability over the next 5 years while this agreement is in place, unless we go to the judge and point these things out and have them removed or renegotiated.
And so what do you recommend for people as far as getting involved in this fairness hearing? Or is there a place they can go to find out how they can have their voice heard there?
Well, yes, there is. The Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, which you mentioned before, is an amicus party to that lawsuit and that settlement, and was required actually by the court to put all the documents about the settlement on their website. So if you go to albinaministerialcoalition.org and then click on the DOJ link, you can find all the documents that you need, including an application about how to testify, an analysis that says here are some of the things that they didn't get right when they wrote the agreement in the first place, and the date and time of the hearing, which again is February 18th, 2014 at 9 a.m.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch.
British Petroleum's attempt to shift the burden of proof onto oil spill victims was rejected by a U.S. judge in federal court. The British oil giant is responsible for the 2010 explosion of the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig, which triggered the largest oil spill in U.S. history. 200 million gallons of crude oil were spilled into the Gulf of Mexico over a period of approximately 3 months. In 2012, BP agreed to a settlement that would help victims with medical bills and economic losses resulting from the spill. BP has been reluctant to reimburse families and businesses for their losses despite agreeing to an out-of-court settlement. Last September, the court-appointed administrator of the settlement program was accused of slow-walking and attempting to defund the program. BP has also continued to pressure courts to stop the multi-billion-dollar settlement program. Payments to businesses affected by the spill were temporarily suspended earlier this month when a federal court judge was asked to reconsider BP's case. The judge ruled that BP's case is, quote, not only clearly inconsistent with its previous position, it directly contradicts what it has told this court.
California is preparing to implement the nation's very first state law spelling out the rights of transgender students to use restrooms and join sports teams as the gender with which they identify. However, the law, called the School Success and Opportunity Act, may be suspended before its January 1st implementation if opposition groups manage to get a repeal initiative onto next year's ballot. The conservative coalition, Privacy for All Students, submitted over 600,000 signatures to the state this week. For more on this law, KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with Mason Davis, executive director of the Transgender Law Center, which is based in San Francisco.
So can you give me a brief bit of background on the School Success and Opportunity Act that will be implemented on January 1st?
The School Success and Opportunity Act, or AB 1266, was signed into law this year and simply restates existing state and federal law to make sure that schools understand their obligations to meet the needs of transgender students. Now, all youth deserve to have the support they need to participate and succeed in school, but we found that many schools and administrators weren't aware of their obligation to protect transgender students. And this bill is really designed to help make sure they understand what they need to do to make school programs more accessible to all students, including those who are transgender.
So it's sort of a codification of things that have just been done on an individual basis so far?
Well, we have seen both the federal law and state law. We've seen that in place for years now, and many schools making really great steps to make sure that all transgender students can be treated well in school and to make sure that they have access to the classes and support that they need to be successful. But, you know, we understand many people still don't understand a lot about transgender people, have not worked a lot with transgender students. And so this law helps clarify some of the points that have been areas where transgender students have continued to have some challenges in many school environments.
And what will the implementation look like in schools?
Well, the truth is many schools have already been implementing the spirit of this law because of existing statute. So the main impact in many ways of the School Success and Opportunity Act is to increase awareness of the needs of these youth and the school's obligations. Certainly the media has meant that many schools that have not thought a lot about these issues have affirmatively developed policies to have individualized plans for transgender students who may come out in the school environment. And that should make it a lot easier for transgender youth who are coming out and want to make sure that they have the support they need to be successful.
So this conservative coalition called Privacy for All Students is currently, I believe they submitted their signatures, trying to get a repeal on next year's ballot. Are they close to achieving that goal? And what would happen to the implementation schedule if that happened?
In California, there is a referendum possibility for any new law. If enough signatures are submitted, then any law can be put on hold until it goes to the ballot. Now, when it comes to the School Success and Opportunity Act, there has been a referendum effort in play. We won't find out until January 8th whether or not there are enough signatures needed to put it on the ballot. The law will go into effect on January 1, But that said, we know many schools are already putting the policies in place that they need in general for School Success and Opportunity Act, but also to be consistent with other federal and state laws.
If it were to be repealed, would your organization and the people that you're working with try to reinstate it?
Well, if they do have enough signatures to put it on the ballot, then many groups, including ours, will work really hard to make sure that that law stays on the books and to make sure people understand what their responsibilities are to transgender students. I'll tell you, I have been really struck by how many organizations and how many individuals are really upset that this issue is being debated at all. There shouldn't be any question that our youth are able to have the support they need to succeed in school, including students who happen to be transgender. So I feel like, one, it seems unlikely that they've had enough support to actually put it on the ballot. But if it does go to the ballot, that we will see many fair-minded Californians standing with students, including those who are transgender, to make sure that they're able to be an equal part of the school community.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Mason Davis, Executive Director of the Transgender Law Center.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for a special all-Russia edition of Feature Story News after this newscast, followed by the Wisdom of Elders at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be overcast with a high of 47 and a low of 38. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 32 counts per minute in North Portland with a high of 51. Damascus, Oregon has a count of 30 CPM with a high of 47. Pal Butte measures 27 CPM, and Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 36 counts per minute with spikes up to 56. EPA alerts levels start at 100 counts per minute. More information can be found at radcast.org.
It's 5:19 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Never have so few done so little for so many. But at last, they're gone. Congress has adjourned for the year.
I've met
what
him.
A year it was. A few numbers sum up the sorry story, so let's review them. For example, 16. That's the number of days that a gaggle of Tea Party Republicans shut down our government by throwing an October hissy fit. Oh, add $24 billion to that. $24 billion is the economic loss America suffered from the Tea Partiers' shutdown stunt. Speaking of stunts, check out the number of times the House GOP has voted to make the political point that it doesn't want Obamacare to work. It now totals 47 times. Now here's a telling number, 239. That's how many paid days off our Congress critters gave themselves in 2013. Yes, for two-thirds of the year, they were no-shows at their ornate workplace. Hey, stuff like shutting down government and casting meaningless votes is tiring, and you've got to get your rest to keep up the pace. And here's a big angry number that our well-heeled lawmakers can't seem to see. 11 million. That's how many of our fellow Americans are jobless, some 4 million of whom have been out of work for more than 6 months. Yet, Congress went AWOL on its duty to respond to this raging job crisis. However, members did show up to slap America's hardest-hit workers. Just before taking off for their Christmas break, GOP lawmakers pushed a budget deal that killed an emergency benefit program for people who are mired in the misery of long-term unemployment. Yes, in the season of joy and goodwill, Congress, ho, 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 cut off this essential lifeline for 1.3 million workers and their families. Another 1.9 million will lose their benefits next year. This is Jim Hightower saying, but hey, who's counting? It's all just a bunch of numbers to Congress.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
24 U.S. cities are waiting to find out which 6 cities will be selected for new drone testing sites. Oklahoma estimates they will receive over $200 million in tax revenues per year if chosen from the 24 test sites being considered. The Federal Aviation Association will announce by the end of December that it will provide a roadmap for drone applications in civilian life. This includes the integration of larger, high-altitude unmanned aircraft into the air traffic control system, as well as smaller craft that will be used for police and firefighting operations. Yet, it is unclear how the airspace will be managed, but manufacturers are gearing up for production for many civilian applications. Drones will be a routine concept in 10 years, boasts James Grimsley, CEO of Design Intelligence Corporation, a tech company that is developing solar-powered unmanned aerial vehicles. As the drones get smaller and cheaper, in addition to policing and crowd control applications, they're being designed to be used for more ordinary tasks such as predicting tornadoes, household deliveries, and surveying livestock on cattle ranches. As the regulations for the operation of civilian drones are being debated, it is not slowing down the invention and manufacturing of drone equipment in the USA.
A polio epidemic in Syria has reached epic proportions, according to the World Health Organization. The United Nations announces that it will spend $6.5 billion to fund humanitarian efforts that include massive immunization efforts for the deadly disease. This amount is equal to all other humanitarian efforts in the world combined, and this underscores the widespread tragedy going on in Syria. 4 months after the chemical attacks, which killed 1,400 people, the United Nations is running out of options to deal with President al-Assad's regime. It's imperative that the Assad regime must grant access for polio vaccinations to prevent the spread to other regional areas. One child in 200 in Syria shows symptoms of the disease, and polio will paralyze children under 5 in a matter of hours. Immunization rates have plummeted 20% since the war began due to restricted access to the various regions of Syria.
In the rest of Central African Republic, African Union peacekeepers have discovered a mass grave in the capital city of Bangui containing 30 bodies. The corpses, found scattered about an outer area of Bangui called Panther's Hill, near a military compound, show signs of detention and torture and were likely killed elsewhere and brought there. According to a Red Cross representative to Reuters news agency, those discovered in the mass grave were only some among 44 bodies total to come out of the Bangui in the past 2 days. 6 peacekeepers from Chad were killed and 15 wounded in a Christmas Day ambush in the capital city. Intense sectarian and religious violence in the capital and throughout the country amongst Muslims and Christians has played out since the predominantly Muslim Seleka rebel group staged a coup in March. The French and African militaries on the ground have been working to quell the violence, but Associated Press called the country, quote, perilously close to civil war.
In the Ukraine, a journalist and activist well known for her probes into government and police corruption has been severely beaten by multiple attackers. This morning, protesters descended upon the Interior Ministry in Kyiv and expressed anger and suspicion that Ukrainian authorities were behind the Wednesday attack, which left Tetyana Chernovil in intensive care and in need of facial surgery. According to the Ukrainian press, Chernovil told police she was forced off the road by a mysterious SUV while driving in the early morning and then dragged from her car, beaten by several men, and abandoned. An online statement by the Interior Ministry said that they had identified 3 suspects, had arrested 2, but gave no further information. A representative of the opposition in Kyiv told the Guardian newspaper that they were independently investigating her beating, including video footage captured by a dashboard camera in her car of parts of the attack, including footage of the assailant's vehicle. Chernobyl's work as a journalist and activist have coincided with over a month of widespread protests in the capital city of Kiev against Ukraine's Russian-allied government, with demonstrators calling for closer economic ties with the European Union instead. She has conducted corruption investigations into several politicians and officials, such as the Interior Minister, Vitaly Zakhachenko, and has participated in activism against police misconduct and corruption. The attack came just hours after the publication of an article she wrote about the assets of some senior Ukrainian politicians.
According to the Afghan Interior Ministry, various Afghan military and intelligence operations across the country on Christmas Day led to the deaths of 16 Taliban insurgents, the injury of 7, and the arrest of 10. Operations were conducted in Nangarhar, Kunduz, Balkh, Maiden, Wardak, and Helmand provinces, according to the Interior Ministry statement. Also included was Lakhman province, where Afghan intelligence stopped a suicide bomb plot on a government compound and arrested 5 insurgents involved with the plan. Afghan authorities had less luck stopping several bombings elsewhere in the country on Wednesday. In Logar province, a bicycle strapped with explosives was set off in a busy thoroughfare near a restaurant, killing 4 civilians and 2 police. And in the capital, Kabul city, the U.S. Embassy compound was fired upon with twin rocket blasts, but no one was injured, and the rockets hit open areas, missing buildings and leaving no significant structural damage.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, December 26, 2013. Israeli settler injures a Palestinian child while soldiers destroy farmlands and kidnap a number of civilians during attacks targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian sources announced that a Palestinian child was injured on Thursday afternoon after he was hit by an Israeli settler car near Salfit City in the northern part of the West Bank. Ibrahim Abu Zayed, 11 years old, from Deir Istia village near Salfit, sustained critical wounds and was moved to an Israeli hospital for treatment. The sources added that the settler hit the child and fled the scene. Also on Thursday afternoon, Israeli soldiers invaded the city of Bethlehem, southern West Bank, and kidnapped 4 civilians, among them a child. According to local sources, invading troops opened fire at residents' homes in downtown Bethlehem City and searched homes before kidnapping Muhammad Soman, 13, and his father Abdus Salam, in addition to 2 other men. Earlier on Thursday morning, the Israeli army has destroyed dozens of dunams of agricultural land south of the West Bank town of Qalqilia, according to witnesses. Witnesses say that the Israeli army brought heavy machinery to uproot almond, citrus, and olive trees in the area and to level land in a part of the town adjacent to the segregation wall. The soldiers have prevented farmers and landowners from reaching that area. In other news, and for the 63rd time, Israeli forces have demolished the Bedouin village of Al-Araqib in the Negev Thursday morning. Local sources said that bulldozers, escorted by 25 police patrols, raided the village at 9 a.m. and demolished all of its steel houses. Bedouins claim that they are living in their ancestral lands, while Israel considers Al-Araqib and all Bedouin villagers in the Negev illegal. There are around 260,000 Bedouins in Israel, mostly living in and around the Negev. More than half live in unrecognized villages without utilities, with many living in extreme poverty. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, December 26, 2013, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Badnoura.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jenny Kahns, Jen Chavez, Kristen Yount, Barbara Nelson, Gabriel Adra, and our producer is Sam Borman. Our engineer is Pat Epstein. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO, Portland 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Coming up Friday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Positively Revolting Talk Radio, a variety of topics from an eco-feminist and anarcho-feminist perspective. At 9, on One Land, Many Voices, co-hosts Ned Roche and Zaha Hassan interview Ziad Abbas from the Middle East Children Alliance and Mohammed Nabil, a Palestinian student from Gaza, about the crisis in Gaza as a result of the fuel shortage. They also speak with local activist Tom Bell about the international call for the boycott of SodaStream. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on the Radio Zine, we hear part one of a panel discussion on Fukushima, Hanford, and the Columbia Generating Station with Miriam German of Radcast.org, along with activists Lloyd Marbet, John Bertucci, Dan Seres, Chuck Johnson, and Malcolm Chaddock. Thanks to all of you for listening to KBOO, and thanks to KBOO members for your generous support for community radio. If you're not yet a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for a special All-Russia report from Feature Story News. Good night, Rosalind.
Good night, Robert.
Good night, Pat.
Good night.
Good night.
From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's special edition of the program, I'm joined by FSN's Russia correspondents, alongside a Washington-based expert on U.S.-Russia relations, as we take a look at the year's top stories from the region. We'll look at Russia's role in the Syria conflict and the removal and destruction of Bashar Assad's chemical weapons.
And I want to thank President Putin for his willingness to pick up on the possibility of negotiating an end to Syrian weapons of mass destruction.
The temporary asylum Moscow handed to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, much to the anger of the US government. And we examine Russia's gay propaganda law ahead of the 2014 Sochi Winter Games. That's coming up on our special edition of FSN Reports, after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Malcolm Brown.
There have been strong reactions to a visit by Japan's prime minister to a controversial shrine honoring the country's war dead. Shinzo Abe became the first serving prime minister in 7 years to visit the Yasukuni Shrine. China and South Korea both issued strong statements of condemnation. The US, a Japanese ally, is expressing disappointment and warning that the visit will exacerbate tensions in the region. An American captured over 2 years ago by Al-Qaeda has appeared in a new video appealing for Washington to negotiate his release. Warren Weinstein was working as a contractor for the US government when he was kidnapped in Pakistan back in 2011. Bearded and wearing a grey tracksuit, the aging prisoner said that captivity had taken its toll.
9 years ago, I came to Pakistan to help my government. And I did so at a time when most Americans would not come here. And now, when I need my government, it seems that I have been totally abandoned.
From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN. An ice storm continues to affect the northeastern United States and parts of Canada, where thousands of people remain without power. Crews are working to restore electricity, but are warning that may not happen before Saturday. Nina Maria Potts reports.
At least 27 deaths in the region have been linked to the ice storm, most caused by apparent carbon monoxide poisoning with people using gas generators, after homes and businesses in parts of the central and northeastern United States and Canada were thrown into darkness. Many are still without power. The entire region is under a cold alert, with temperatures still below freezing. Some U.S. states kept emergency shelters open for people without power. In Canada, tens of thousands of people have been warned they may not have electricity restored to them until Saturday, while meteorologists are warning the extreme weather could last a few days yet. Nina Maria Potts, Washington.
Meanwhile, delivery companies in the U.S. are playing catch-up. Shipping giants UPS and Federal Express say they weren't able to deliver some holiday packages on time due to high volume and bad weather in parts of the country. Mary McCarthy reports.
Christmas is over, but the presents have not yet arrived for some Americans as United Parcel Service and Federal Express rushed to deliver packages that were supposed to arrive on time for the holiday. UPS said the volume of airmail packages exceeded the capacity of its network in the lead-up to Christmas this year. Much of the demand came from online retailer Amazon.com, which said that customers should receive their orders by Friday and that those with delivery guarantees will get refunds. Meanwhile, FedEx says it handled some 275 million shipments between Thanksgiving and Christmas. It has not given numbers on how many deliveries are arriving late, but did allow some customers to pick up packages at local offices on Christmas Day. In Denver, I'm Mary McCarthy.
And that's the latest feature story news. Malcolm Brown reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Welcome to all three of you, FSN Moscow Bureau Chief Anya Ardaeva, Russia correspondent Tom Barton, and Fiona Hill from the Brookings Institute here in Washington, D.C., an expert and frequent commentator on Russia and the state of the former Soviet Union. Thanks for joining me for our look back at a remarkable year in many ways for Russia and the man at the helm, President Vladimir Putin. And let's start with Syria and the role Russia took in the conflict in terms of UN weapons inspectors entering Syria, instead perhaps of America taking a path of military intervention.
The United States and Russia have agreed that the Syrians must provide the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons and supporting personnel with an immediate and unfettered right to inspect any and all sites in Syria.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry earlier this year outlining the agreement between the U.S. and Russia for the elimination of Syria's chemical weapons. This was quite a diplomatic coup on the part of the Russian leader.
Yeah, of course. It was indeed. I mean, there's analysts and journalists out here in Moscow saying that I think you've got to hand Putin some credit because he did and his foreign ministry were very light-footed, and they did manage to really jump on that sort of throwaway announcement by John Kerry and then build it with the US inclusively into a proposal which is actually perhaps, hopefully, going to see all of Assad's chemical arsenal gone. There's still a big question mark over that, but covering that the way it went, it was a real work of diplomacy there, I think.
Fiona, would you agree with that? I mean, it sort of came out of nowhere, didn't it? And suddenly Russia finds itself on the world stage leading a possible solution to a crisis which has everyone in gridlock almost.
The main precedent that the Russians have set by establishing the resolution of the chemical weapons disposal inside of the United Nations framework is that the future resolution of the ongoing conflict in Syria itself, the civil war, should be only carried out within the framework of the United Nations and the United Nations Security Council, where Russia obviously has a veto. And this is very important because the Russians have been standing on the position for a very long time on Syria and on many other issues that there should be no unilateral intervention by the United States or by any other country. They have come out very strongly against any form of regime change. Obviously, the developments in Libya were very disturbing to Putin personally, as he's made quite clear. This is the summary execution of Gaddafi in the wake of the intervention by the NATO partners in Libya. And they also, the Russians have been at great pains for a very long time to head off any kind of intervention, military intervention or strike against Iran by the United States or Israel in response to Iran's nuclear program. So they want to make sure that in future, any kind of resolution of these kind of thorny problems is within the United Nations, where they can control the situation to some degree. And what we're going to see moving forward on Syria is the push by the Russians to keep the discussions about the conflict, the civil war itself, within the United Nations framework, within this Geneva process that they have also championed, and to make sure that we follow the same rules as we have for the chemical weapons of collaboration, cooperation, and really the United Nations being in the driving seat.
It did not receive a lot of coverage in Russia, unfortunately. I don't think many people out there on the streets knew exactly what was published in that article in the New York Times. Of course, certain people followed that. But I have a question for Fiona. How important is that solution to the Syrian conflict that was found by Russia, the United States and other countries? How important of a precedent does that set for future conflicts of this kind, internal conflicts? Because this, I think it is the first time probably in many, many years when that conflict will be eventually resolved in a peaceful way. Do you think that sets an important precedent and that will help to avoid military interventions in the future?
So although we've had a real success on the chemical weapons of taking those out of the conflict, we haven't had a great deal of progress on resolving the civil war and the brutal slaughter that's taking place there and the huge humanitarian crisis, which is almost unprecedented in recent history. But the precedent has been set of resolving these in a multilateral framework inside the United Nations, because there's now an agreement that the process for resolving the civil war, the ongoing conflict on the ground in Syria, will also be in a context that's framed by the United Nations. And this is really important for other issues that Russia is very concerned about, like dealing with the Iranian nuclear program, where we've got an interim agreement underway, and for other potential conflicts, not just in the Middle East, but elsewhere. I mean, Russia has really made it very clear, as they did in that New York Times piece under Putin's byline, that they do not want to see any kind of unilateral action by the United States or by any constellation of players that forms a repetition of action in Iraq or anywhere else. They've mentioned Libya, obviously, too. We do know, of course, that the Russians have been digging in their feet about Syria for some considerable period now. So in many respects, they are going to have the resolution, the end game in Syria on their terms to some degree as well.
A story that we simply have to get onto. Let's go back to June. A certain Edward Snowden touched down in a Moscow airport. Can you explain to us in Moscow what the reaction was like and what sort of reception the whistleblower, as some people would call him, or fugitive, as the United States government would have it, received?
Yeah, I remember camping out at that airport in the north of Moscow day in, day out. The hours after hours and all the journalists were trying to find Snowden. And at times it became really quite comical, that they seek him here, they seek him there sort of story. And obviously for him, though, it probably wasn't half as fun. He was stuck in that airport hotel. And I think that as he sat there, as the weeks ticked by, it became very much a story of two sides, really. A, this international outcry that Snowden had exposed something very important and that the US and its allies should not be trying to persecute him in the eyes of some. And on the other side, many people in the US feeling that but he was more than just a fugitive, a traitor to the United States that had betrayed their secrets. And Vladimir Putin himself came out and said that asylum would only be given to Snowden if he stopped damaging the United States. And we hear him saying similar things since then as well.
Could you argue that this reaction by Putin, the decision to grant him temporary asylum, maybe changed the perception of the leader, even in the eyes of some civil liberties groups, after offering this man refuge?
Certainly. It definitely played into Putin's popularity on the world stage as someone who is, you know, harboring a man who is sought by the United States, but who is also viewed by many people as not exactly a criminal, but someone who is trying to disclose what some people view as a government abuse of the technology. What is also important is that Edward Snowden has become quite popular in Russia. I think there is no Russian at the moment who would not know that name. I have a question for Fiona. Do you think the U.S. government at the moment has any leverage or any sort of tool it could use to bring Edward Snowden back to the US, or is that not an option anymore?
I don't really see any tools right now that they could use. I guess the most likely scenario is if he tries to move from Russia to somewhere else. I guess Brazil may be in play right now based on some of the news reports. And then the question is whether the United States could interdict him in transit. Otherwise, it looks like Snowden is there to stay in Moscow for now. Obviously, the reverberations of the Snowden affair continue here in the United States, most especially as it affects key relationships for the U.S. with Germany, one of the U.S.'s major allies, and also with Brazil, one of the rising powers, where there's been a really fierce reaction to the revelations. The bigger question, of course, is how this affects policy going forward. Lots of hearings in the U.S. Congress, some discussions obviously that feature on the private sector and companies like Microsoft and many others and the implications for them of these revelations. But it hasn't really played out in the United States in ways that, you know, perhaps Edward Snowden and others might have expected, because in many respects, the revelations underscore that no U.S. domestic laws were broken. So there hasn't been the kind of debate that perhaps Snowden might have envisaged internally about privacy and, you know, data protection, which obviously seems to be one of the goals. It's really been outside that you've had that that discussion. And there's been much more focus, obviously, in the press reports about the damage that Snowden has done to U.S. alliances as well as to U.S. reputation, and potentially opening the door for the utilization of the information that he's provided by China, Russia and other countries to step up their own game on espionage.
Can I ask you guys in Moscow, what sort of existence is Edward Snowden living? I mean, is he incognito, or is he actually carving out some sort of a lifestyle there?
I think it would be fair to say that nobody has seen Edward Snowden in person ever since he was in Russia, only briefly during a press conference that he held while he was still in the airport with human rights activists. After there was one photo that emerged from that meeting. After that, no one has seen the man, and nobody knows where exactly he is. It was reported that he got a job with the Russian social network Vkontakte, but what position he got there and what kind of arrangement he's received is not clear. The lawyer, the Russian lawyer, Anatoly Kucherena, who was assisting Snowden in his plight, he said that Edward Snowden was learning Russian, that he's already learned a few phrases, and that he was studying Russian literature. But that's all we know at this point about Edward Snowden's whereabouts.
Perhaps he's hoping to escape to warmer climes. So if Snowden represents a frosty relationship between the US and Russia, an even frostier environment is the Arctic, where we had oil drilling, a protest against oil drilling earlier this year, which resulted in the detention of 30 people. Now, this story has moved on, certainly in recent weeks, but explain to our listeners what happened. Take us back.
Well, it all really jumped off in September when this boat, the Arctic Sunrise, appeared a few miles away from a giant Gazprom oil rig in the Arctic seas there. And it was very, very dramatic pictures and of pictures of the speedboats. Well, we've all seen Greenpeace's sort of tactics before. They're designed to be dramatic. But what was also dramatic was the response of the security forces, who abseiled down from helicopters and held everyone on board. And they were armed with guns at the time as well. And so it was very much a dramatic thing. And there was a large PR campaign going on Greenpeace's part and for their own part from the Russian authorities to try and justify what they were doing as it was happening. And then we got to the criminal charges stage. First of all, piracy, which really took everyone very much by surprise. And then perhaps the Russian authorities realised that they couldn't really be taken seriously holding such a charge, and then reduced it down to hooliganism, which itself is a word that's always in the headlines in Russia these days.
And Fiona, there's now a possibility that thanks to an amnesty from Mr. Putin, these people may be home for Christmas.
Yes, well, maybe. I think we'll have to see about that because, it's entirely possible. But then the question is, will they be allowed to be going back to Russia again? Will there also be restrictions on them for, future travel and activities? But also, I think Putin's made it very clear that he hopes that they've learned a lesson. I mean, again, this is a signal to everyone else that if you contemplate protests like this on projects that are very important to Russian interests in the Arctic, or be it at the Winter Olympics or the future soccer World Cup, you'd better think twice because there will be consequences. And Putin, in his recent press set of interviews, underscored this. He said, hopefully these people in future will be more constructive in their approach to working with the Russian government.
Fiona, you mentioned the Sochi 2014 Winter Games, which are just months away now. Guys, in Moscow, I wonder if you could sort of explain to us how important this is for Putin's legacy.
Oh, it is extremely important. I would think that he views this as probably one of his missions while he's serving as the Russian president. It is now his third term. And he has said repeatedly that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the biggest tragedy for Russia. And of course, people of his generation remember the Olympic Games in Moscow of 1980. And that was a huge event. Many people here have a lot of fond memories of that event, and it helped to develop the infrastructure in the city significantly. So this is certainly something that Vladimir Putin is hoping to achieve. He's hoping that he will remain in history of Russia as someone who helped Russia to host Winter Olympic Games in Sochi in 2014.
It's not all rosy when it comes to the Sochi Winter Olympics, apart from being one of Putin's pet projects. Unfortunately, an awful lot has already gone wrong with Sochi. It's massively over budget. There's accusations that workers building the sites have been mistreated. And there's the potential for protests there as well.
There's a chance that these games have already been overshadowed, partly down to Russia's homosexual propaganda law, which was passed earlier this year. Was this a big backfire, do you think, Fiona? Because I'm sure even Vladimir Putin himself has been shocked by the international outrage. And if you just remind us the details of this law.
Well, this is a piece of legislation that went through the Russian Duma against propaganda, essentially, against the publicity or the publication of materials related to homosexual lifestyle. Essentially books, textbooks and other materials that might be used in schools, because it was directed against, it's really rather a bizarre idea, the promulgation of information about an alternative sexuality for among minors. where there hasn't exactly been an embrace of same-sex marriage or of the same kind of legislation that we've been pushing through in the United States and in other European countries. Russia is some years behind where other countries have moved and is much more rigid on these kinds of issues. And it wasn't so long ago that homosexuality was completely outlawed in old Soviet legislation. So Putin probably thought that this was quite an easy win on the domestic front. But there's also been some backfiring from his perspective. There have been some really brutal assaults on homosexual figures, public figures, and in Russia itself, people being sacked from their jobs when they've been outed, people being literally brutalized in gang attacks in Russian cities. And Putin's had to, on the domestic front as well, step back and said, hey, you know, this legislation wasn't meant to mean that this was a free-for-all on our citizens who are homosexual, that this is, you know, their right, their freedom. I'm not kind of making a blanket discrimination against them. This is just a very narrow piece of legislation against, you know, basically the dissemination of material. So, you know, he's trying to have the opportunity to push forward this agenda and be able to calibrate it at the same time. And as we know, of course, in all kinds of instances related to these issues, it's a very dangerous line that you have to tread here, because this has really opened up a free-for-all on the domestic front. And, of course, you've had this international backlash, especially ahead of the Olympics, where this is completely contrary to the Olympic spirit. So he's having to tack on this issue both at home and abroad to try to prevent the Olympics from being overshadowed, but also to roll back these vicious assaults that have been happening at home.
It's a question to all three of you on the Sochi subject, really. The US has snubbed the Winter Games by sending a delegation. I don't think it actually carries any high-ranking White House Obama administration officials in it at all. But what it is peppered with is high-profile gay athletes as a snub, perhaps, to this homosexual propaganda law. Do you think that sort of thing will actually bother the Russian president? Or is it just water off a duck's back?
I think that I think it probably will bother them. They won't. If it does, they certainly will try not to let it show. And I think the message is really there that they want to try and make everyone welcome. Putin said that more than once. Everyone is welcome. And yet, after all of these so-called anti-gay propaganda laws, it's been whipped into such a firestorm now that people cannot stop discussing this idea that Russia is moving backwards while their European neighbours are moving forwards with this kind of legislation. And we've already seen attempts at athletics competitions to try and protest that kind of thing.
And there's been an awful lot of pressure here domestically by many groups on the White House to send some strong signal. Some people were obviously calling for a boycott of the Winter Olympics. I don't think the administration wanted to go that far. And in actual fact, as we know from looking back at the Olympics of 1980 in Moscow and other settings, that boycotts don't always get the message across that you want to get across.
I wanted to talk about another very smooth, swerving move by Vladimir Putin this year, and that was somehow managing to prize Ukraine away from the warm trade embrace of the European Union. This was quite something, considering the protests that we've seen over the last 3 weeks.
Vladimir Putin insisted, though, that this decision to give Ukraine $15 billion in various investments, that it has nothing to do, that's what he insisted on, that it has nothing to do with neither the deal that Ukraine was expected to sign with the European Union nor the protests. He said that Ukraine is the sister, the brother nation of Russia, and because of Russia and Ukraine are being good neighbors, Russia has to help Ukraine, which, and the economy in that country is not doing so well. It's been in a regression in the past 2 years.
Fiona, what does this tell us about what's happening in that region in terms of the relationship between Moscow, Ukraine, and of course the EU?
It actually tells us a number of things. Because of the fact that Ukraine is not just historically and culturally closely tied to Russia, as Putin's been stressing for the best part of the year, but also economically, there is a great deal of overlap with the manufacturing sectors of Ukraine and Russia. There's a lot of Russian investment in Ukraine that obviously is seen as quite strategic. And Putin's been trying to push forward with the expansion of a pre-existing customs union that Russia has with Belarus and with Kazakhstan, two other neighbouring countries, and trying to get Ukraine to join in the expectation that this will pull along many of the other former Soviet republics. The other thing that this tells us is that Putin wants to move at all costs to stem these demonstrations in Ukraine. This looks very bad from the Russian perspective. It would be interesting to hear from Annie and Tom how much the Ukrainian demonstrations are getting played out on Russian TV. But Putin has managed to push back the opposition movement from Russia's streets, and seeing hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people every day on the main square of Kiev must be rather troubling for Putin, because this does send a signal that, look, people in the region are able to mobilise on their own, and that this could be a real threat to the order. So I think Putin's going to do whatever it takes to help Yanukovych beat back these demonstrations, in the fear that this, you know, could set a precedent for further demonstrations in Russia itself.
As Fiona was saying, yeah, there has been a lot of controversy over Russian media coverage of these protests. And unfortunately, many of those observing it from the outside say the coverage is woefully inadequate. And they've even gone as far to say that it's really quite anti-Ukrainian propaganda. One of these broadcasts, live on air, one of the protesters interrupted a live broadcast by a Russian correspondent and handed the presenter on the other end with a fake Oscar for lies and misrepresentation of the situation. And then the reporter went on to push him back off screen and describe how hate-filled all the protesters there were.
And that's where we'll have to leave it. We're out of time, but it just remains for me to say thank you to the three of you. FSN's Moscow Bureau Chief Anya Ardaeva, FSN's Russia correspondent Tom Barton, and Fiona Hill from the Brookings Institute here in Washington, D.C. The special editions of FSN Reports continue tomorrow with a look at the assassination of former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.
And you're listening to Wisdom of the Elders right here on KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Wisdom of the Elders, featuring the stories and songs of elders from the Native nations who lived and still live along the Lewis and Clark Trail. I'm Arlie Neskai of the Diné Nation. In the next hour, we'll feature the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde Community of Oregon. We'll swim with Ilaka, the sea otter, and we'll hear how one mother teaches her children through song. We'll learn about Grand Ronde efforts in the battle against diabetes, and gather junkas with a basket maker. Then we'll learn of the Grand Ronde Tribe's Trail of Tears. But first, we'll meet the late elder, Michael Ryback.
It was a time of unsettlement and great sadness and sorrow amongst our people. It was a time of our Trail of Tears.
This is Wisdom of the Elders. Stay with us. This is Clandestine performing Santa Fe from their self-titled album on the Canyon Records label.